Illinois is getting national attention today because if lawmakers don't reach an agreement by tomorrow, the state will enter an unprecedented third year without a budget. Leaders from both parties have been meeting in private, and they've been keeping quiet on how negotiations are really going.
Every day that we meet, we talk and we can agree and disagree, but I'm not getting specifics. But I'll say the meeting was productive.
Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin will find out what they're not saying. Plus, the Trump administration says airlines need to step up security. What will this mean for summer travel? NPR's David Shaper joins us. Also, the Cubs let go of catcher Miguel Montero yesterday.
Factoring in everything, made the decision that, you know, we're going to move on without Miggy. Doesn't mean we don't have, you know, a ton of respect and appreciation for what he did for us for 2.5 years.
That was Cubs GM Jed Hoyer speaking with the Tribune. WBEZ's Cheryl Reistow joins us to talk about Cubs and other sports. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois lawmakers must pass a budget by tomorrow if they want to avoid a third year without a spending plan. That is, unless Governor Rauner calls another special session, which he's threatened to do yesterday, if legislators don't send him a budget by the end of the current special session. That's been 10 days. We're on day 9. Meanwhile, Democratic and Republican leaders have been holding private meetings after avoiding each other all year. Is this a sign that real negotiations are actually finally happening? On a day when Illinois politics is getting lots of national attention, we wanted to check in with two political reporters to help us better understand where we are, whether or not there's any real hope for an agreement. Natasha Karecki writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. Monique Garcia is the State House Bureau reporter for the Tribune. Monique, Natasha, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Today seems to be the day that Illinois has become a national story. I'm thinking about the Wall Street Journal seeming to pick up this issue. Natasha, you were just on 1A talking about the same issue. I'm going to be on Here and Now later this afternoon. Natasha, I wanted to ask you, as you're seeing more national media attention to this, what stood out to you?
Well, one thing that I find interesting is that nationally people have tuned out. They're really shocked when they hear the numbers, like $14.6 billion in unpaid bills. What? You know, the pension liability, you add everything up, a junk bond status. People are now really tuning in. And I think the other takeaway from that is that as you have sort of like national pundits and you have Wall Street Journal and you have just more exposure nationally, I think it kind of turns up the heat on lawmakers. I feel like I hear from them a little bit more after some of these reports come out in kind of a defensive tone, like, hey, I did this. Hey, we did this. Hey, we tried kind of thing. And I do think that there is, to whatever extent there's any shame with Illinois politicians right now, it helps kind of turn the heat up on them.
Yeah, Monique, I wonder about that. I mean, if we're thinking about whether or not we're becoming sort of a laughingstock, or as Natasha's saying, people are just sort of shocked at how bad it is in Illinois. What's your sense of where Democratic and Republican leaders are right now? Do you have the sense that they feel the pressure on them, whether it's internally within the state or externally as well?
Well, the pressure has been there for a very long time. The question is, at what point does it build to an explosion? And that's something that hasn't happened yet. While the national media is just now starting to pay attention to this, this has been going on for 3 years. And the headlines have continued to come out, but yet they persist in their very deep seated positions and refuse to kind of meet in the middle here to solve this. So it does probably light a fire under them to try to do something, or to at least show that they're trying to do something, which is what we've seen time and time again when they reach these crisis points.
And Monique, their meeting yesterday, the fact that we didn't hear much, do you think that's a good sign?
In the past, being silent is a good sign that something's getting done, but I caution against assigning meaning to something that we're not really sure what's happening. And I say that because a lot of this is, you know, what's happening publicly. And while they were meeting yesterday, House Speaker Michael Madigan held a series of votes on bills that Republicans repeatedly said that they could not support. So you have to wonder, as Republicans have raised, you know, where is the sincerity in trying to cut a deal? Why do you hold hold these votes on the floor to have us argue publicly and hash it out for all the world to see if there really is an effort to try to reach a deal behind the scenes.
Natasha, let's talk about the fact that both Democrats and Republicans have put forward budget proposals, but we're not really seeing, I feel like if we could air quote budget, we should, because we're not really seeing the revenue side of this, are we?
Well, no, we're not. And that's, you know, for, obviously for a reason. I mean, of course, we did see it from Senate Democrats, but they are the exception. You know, we had House Republicans and now House Democrats put forward their spending plans, but they don't want to show their cards on, you know, a tax increase. And I mean, I think that speaks to the level of distrust between the two sides still. And, you know, as Monique was talking about all the talks, you know, it's gotten to the point where Mike Madigan said, I'll sit down and talk, but I cannot talk to Bruce Rauner anymore. So it you know, I think it speaks to that distrust. If we start seeing somebody lay down their cards, maybe that's a step in the right direction. But it's, you know, yeah, it's Thursday. We have until tomorrow. Lots of terrible things will happen, you know, as we all know, if this doesn't move forward.
Monique, everyone's talking, everyone's using the word compromise, and you talked about this, you wrote about this yesterday. We will tweet out that article, by the way, for everyone to see, where you said governors, you know, everyone's sort of on these social media, or as you said, these public things, where everyone's using the word compromise. Governor Rauner, Speaker Madigan. I guess I just wonder how much we can separate political theater from actuality of a sense of, Are there any movements towards where we're seeing compromise possible?
Well, it was interesting because on the floor yesterday, you had members on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, acknowledging that there has been a lot of movement from when this started 3 years ago. And on some issues, they're only apart by maybe one or two very specific but important measures. So they go and say that we've compromised, but yet a deal is still elusive. And a lot of that has to boil down to, as Natasha said, the tax increase. You know, this isn't happening in a vacuum. And everybody in this building is very aware of the politics that's being played outside of the chamber, sometimes even in the chamber. And that is, of course, the governor's election. You know, Republicans say that Democrats don't want to give the governor a win. They don't want to make his job any easier heading into a reelection bid. Democrats don't want to take the blame for raising taxes alone, even though both sides acknowledge pretty clearly that there's going to have to be some kind of tax increase to dig the state out of the financial morass we've been in because there hasn't been a budget in place.
That's Monique Garcia with the Chicago Tribune in the State House in the Capitol in Springfield. Natasha Korecki is also on the line with us. She writes the Illinois playbook for Politico. Natasha, let's talk about revenue and taxes for a little bit. In particular, I want to just ask, before we get back to maybe personal taxes or other taxes for services, property taxes, because that's something Governor Rauner has been very clear about, that he wants this 4-year property tax freeze. Yesterday, House Democrats introduced a bill that would do that, but it failed. What happened there?
Well, the Democratic version of the property tax freeze includes huge exemptions for the city of Chicago, Chicago Public Schools, and some other financially strapped districts and areas in the state. And, you know, Rauner and the Republicans have said for a long time that that's just not going to fly. They want it all included. And, of course, you know, Democrats have their own position on that. And, you know, two of our two Democratic legislative leaders are from Chicago. Which, you know, CPS is facing, you know, they're on the brink of collapse themselves. They're borrowing just to stay open. They borrowed just to stay open through the end of the year. So there's a lot of back and forth on that. You know, as, you know, lots of people have pointed out, and we did again this morning, the property tax issue has, you know, really come front and center in this debate, but it does nothing to balance the budget or to, you know, to move forward on an actual budget, which is what every fiscal watchdog has said is needed right now to at least stop what's happening, to stop the permanent damage that's happening across the state to higher education, to our infrastructure, you name it. And the other thing is, you know, Rauner believes that the property taxes is the issue. That's what he's seizing on for his reelection. That's what they've been messaging nonstop. Of course, the reason property taxes are so high in Illinois is because the state has not adequately funded public education in decades. So they've just shifted the burden to local taxpayers, which are picking it up. So if you end up freezing property taxes, it's going to end up hurting schools unless you've got, you know, some kind of major shift in how we fund education in Illinois.
As always, we welcome your comments. You can tweet to us at 21STShow. Johnny just said, Madigan is only out for himself. If you dump him in our state will improve. Monique, how much of this is about, how much of this do you think is still about a fight between Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner? And how much do we have a sense of how much other leadership, as well as how much rank and file among the House and Senate are playing a role in negotiations?
Well, the personalities are undeniable in this, and not only is there a lack of trust, there's like a negative sense of trust between these two men. They simply just don't see eye to eye ideologically, and even in how you work to cut a deal through the governmental process. And that has caused some friction within the rank and file in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. You know, historically, rank and file have been very loyal to their leaders. Their leaders protect them on issues. They help them fundraise. They help them put mailers out come election time. But folks are feeling very real pressure back home from universities that are about to close, or maybe not close, but have had to cut services dramatically, from social service programs who have had to close their doors.
From K through 12 superintendents, yeah.
Right, you know, and so there are folks who say, you know, you can't protect me when I go back home, Speaker Madigan or Governor. The money helps, the support is nice, but if my constituents are angry and we're not doing anything to address that, it's not going to save me. And so there's an opportunity on both sides to try to, you know, pick at those little one or two folks who are willing to not to toe the line, but there's not been enough of a revolt to really change anything in terms of the current impasse and the standoff.
Natasha, I wanted to ask you, speaking of different of other senators apart from leadership, State Senator Andy Menar, as a Democrat from Bunker Hill, been very active, of course, in school funding, passing the school funding SB1 bill that Speaker Madigan has said is crucial for him, at least, for reaching an agreement with the budget impasse. Yesterday, the Illinois Senate passed bipartisan legislation sponsored by him, asking the Illinois Auditor General to investigate what he said was an unnecessary $2.4 million warehouse deal signed by the Rauner administration. Natasha, what's that about?
Well, you know, the interesting thing here is that it's a couple of warehouse leases, and they are tied to the son-in-law of none other than William Cellini. And anyone following state politics has long known Cellini. He was once known as the king of clout in Illinois. He went, he was convicted in a kind of an offshoot of the Blagojevich investigation. He went to prison. He came out. He was long known as having all of these insider deals. And then here he is. He's out of prison, and there's still a controversial lease that's tied to his son-in-law. This all gets into, you know, how different storage issues with the state, it's this bipartisan legislation, as you mentioned, but they want to look into how were the leases given out, you know, was there insider dealing?
Which, Natasha, this has been a key part of the Rauner administration, that he's there to clean up Illinois and all of the clout and all of these backroom deals. He said that repeatedly.
Well, absolutely. And that is actually what makes this such a major issue for potentially a major issue for Rauner. I mean, it's, you know, why are you giving out these huge lease deals that are unnecessary? You know, was this some kind of insider deal? It goes against every narrative that Rauner has tried portraying himself as. But I should mention that the irony here is that the Auditor General himself, Frank Martino, is
also
under
right.
his own
right.
cloud, yeah, of suspicion. And Republicans have asked for Lisa Madigan to launch a separate investigation into Frank Martino because they believe that he just got a slap on his hand after some improprieties involving his campaign finance account.
Right. So that's a whole other issue that we could probably talk about. We just have about a minute or two left. And Monique, let me just end by asking. So we're day 9 of this day 10 special session. Governor Rauner said yesterday he's going to keep the General Assembly in session. I will remind our listeners that the actual session has not necessarily been more than legislators meeting for more than a few minutes, but they are meeting outside from that. If he doesn't have a budget sent to his desk by tomorrow, do you think, Monique, he's actually going to do that? Continue to ask lawmakers to be here, or you think they're going to be here anyway?
I think that he'll ask for that. Whether or not they show up is another question entirely. As you've mentioned, you know, the House has been here and has been doing some work on the floor, but the Senate, which passed their version of a budget, largely has stayed away and said we've done our job, and it doesn't help to call people back if there isn't an actual deal on the table to vote on. So leaders are set to meet here again in about 10 minutes, and we'll know from there if there's going to be any kind of real movement or if we'll be where we were back in May.
That's Monique Garcia, State House Bureau reporter with the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank Natasha Karecki as well. She writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. Both of them, the Tribune and Politico, have morning newsletters you can sign up for. Both of you, I know, will be actively following this and tweeting this throughout the day, the results of this. Ladies, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. Yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security said that about 180 airlines would be required to take on, quote, enhanced security screenings for passengers flying into the U.S. from certain foreign countries. Here in Illinois, with Chicago's O'Hare Airport being the second busiest in the world, and with us well into the summer travel season, we wanted to get a sense of how these extra security measures would affect everyone. We're joined now by David Shaper. He's NPR's national desk correspondent based in Chicago. Hey, David, welcome back to The 21st.
Well, thanks for having me, Nyla.
David, what exactly are these enhanced security screenings adding? I know back in March, we saw travelers coming in from certain countries in the Middle East and North Africa already being banned from bringing, for example, laptops. Before we get to enhanced, what has the Trump administration implemented in the past couple of months in terms of what travelers can bring in, and what countries are we talking about?
So there are 10 airports, I believe, in 8 countries, and flights that go directly to the U.S. from those countries. Passengers cannot bring laptops on board with them. They have to be in their checked luggage. And the reason for that is that the Department of Homeland Security and other security agencies have said that there is intelligence suggesting a legitimate threat of terrorists trying to get hide bombs inside of laptops and get them on board, where suicide bombers would blow them up on the plane. It has happened twice before. At least it's suspected of happening twice before. There was one airline in the Middle East where a laptop bomb blew up and tore a hole in the plane, but the plane did not crash. It landed safely, and I believe only the bomber himself was killed.
David, can I stop you for a second and ask you something? So is the idea that if it's in checked baggage, does that get extra screening that wouldn't happen at the airport?
Right.
Okay.
So the premises that the checked luggage undergoes a more thorough 3D screening, more like an MRI type thing. And there is more bomb detecting equipment than what you are just going through. Not in this country necessarily, but in a lot of countries. These are mostly Middle Eastern airports that are affected by the current laptop ban. We're talking about airports in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Qatar in, I believe, Turkey.
And I think Morocco, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I think there's a few others in North Africa as well. So and there's been talk that because this threat, the administration believes, is serious, of expanding this ban on laptops being carried on board to airports in Europe and beyond. So the airlines have been very upset about this. They don't want to see a laptop ban for business travelers in particular. This could be, a huge, huge problem in terms of, you're talking about flights that take 8, 10, 12 hours to get, from somewhere on the other side of the world to this country. And, that's a whole workday or more that a business traveler is going without their laptop and then unable to do work. So they've been working with European authorities, the administration has, and the airlines are trying to develop a different plan. And so that's why we have this announcement of enhanced screening, enhanced security measures. And it's global. It affects 280 airports worldwide and airlines that have direct flights into the U.S. from those airports. And it's not without a little bit of controversy itself.
Not without controversy. It sounds like because everything's happening outside the U.S., how will that affect internal travel and airports like O'Hare?
Yeah, I mean, there are airports and airlines that say it's really they're not sure exactly how they're going to meet these measures. The administration is not saying exactly what you have to do, but there just has to be enhanced security measures in place. Better screening, maybe more sophisticated technology, maybe a greater use of bomb-sniffing dogs, which are really quite effective in determining if there's explosive material in carry-on luggage or in electronic devices. So there's a wide range of ways that the airlines and the airports can meet this, but it's going to be costly. It's going to take some time. And the full impact on travelers still is not known. And a couple of the airlines, both here in the U.S. and abroad, are saying that, gee, really wish we could have been more included in the conversation, and there could have been better collaboration with the administration in terms of coming up with ways to exactly, meet this new requirement.
So two last questions for you, David. First, do you think I have a sense that the airlines feel like they have that collaboration now? Do they feel like they're maybe a little bit more a part of the conversation with the administration?
A little bit more, but they're still a little apprehensive. There's a statement put out by the organization Airlines for America, which is the trade group for the airline industry in this country. And they have said that they do wish that there had been greater collaboration on this measure in particular, that they feel they are part of the conversation to a degree, but that, now that it's in place, the statement actually says, quote, "We believe that the development of this security directive should have been subject to a greater degree of collaboration and coordination to avoid significant operational disruptions and unnecessary frustrating consequences for the traveling public that appear likely to happen." So the airlines are trying to tell passengers this is going to be a bumpy ride, so to speak. There's going to be a lot of turbulence, not just on the flight itself, but as you're checking in and trying to figure out how you meet these new security measures.
Well, and I imagine they're also worried about the economic impact of this as well, right? Particularly when we think about business travelers. Like, obviously, we think about airports like O'Hare. There's a concern about revenue coming in if people are not able to, essentially, if they can't work on the plane. But I guess, what other option do they have to get here, David, right?
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is that you're talking about potentially business travelers from the U.S. when they go abroad, they don't have to necessarily are subject to the laptop ban or some of these enhanced screening measures and things like that. But when they come back, they will be. And if it's too much of a hassle, and even business travelers just coming to the U.S., why not do our whatever we need to do via video conference or try to take meetings even over the phone as opposed to meeting people face-to-face unless it's, you know, really needed because of just the logistics and the hassles involved may be that great. Now, we'll
yeah.
see how it plays out.
We'll see how it plays out. And, David, for this travel season, for the summer so far, the last time I talked to you was during sort of the United multiple fiascos in terms of the busy travel season. Advice for other travelers, everything's going kind of okay this far. Is it okay to say that?
It is okay to say this. It's going to be really, really busy at airports. If you're heading out this weekend, if you're heading out anytime for the remainder of the summer, a record level of air travelers this summer. But we're going to have a record number of people hitting the road, too. Gas prices are low. Fuel prices for the airlines are low. That's keeping airfares low. A lot of people are looking to go out. And I think the domestic travel market in particular is going to be really, really busy. So just, you know, make sure you bring a lot of patience along with all your luggage and everything else that you need to have a good time.
That's always good advice from NPR's David Schaefer. David, always great to talk to you. Thanks for being with me.
Well, thanks.
A dispute in the heart of the Mississippi River Basin has Missouri and Illinois fighting like angry neighbors. The argument is over the height of levees each state is building on each side of the river. We're joined now by Bryce Gray. He's a reporter with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and has written about this issue. Hey, Bryce, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this is something that's been going on for a while, but what's the main issue here?
Basically, levee heights are being called into question throughout the upper Mississippi region and down here around St. Louis as well. You know, these 100-year floods or historic floods basically have been happening, you know, curiously more often than their name would suggest over the last few years. And at least down in St. Louis, that's called some attention to the heights of a few levees here. And a recent report by the Rock Island District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers found that 40% of levees up in upstream, basically, are also overbuilt. So there's evidence that it's, you know, a bit more of a systemic problem than, you know, it's not an isolated incident, basically.
Bryce, so you're in the newsroom of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I wonder if you can give us the perspective from your side of the river. How are lawmakers and citizens handling this issue?
It's something that has basically just generated discussion at this point. There hasn't really been, you know, much happening politically in terms of I don't know, any changes being made to levee heights. At this point, it's sort of a kind of a wait-and-see approach. So I know the St. Louis District of the Corps is also doing their own look at levee heights here to see if, you know, we also have a bunch of overbuilt structures as they do upstream in the Rock Island District. You know, with a couple of these major floods happening in the last couple of years, a growing number of people are looking around to see, you know, if there's, you know, another explanation besides just rainfall about why these episodes are happening. And, you know, some do point to levees as evidence that, you know, these river basins are more constrained than they should be and that that's playing a role in worsening flooding.
I should say we reached out to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. We invited them to join us on today's program. They denied that request, but they did send us a statement for us to read that said, in part, Illinois DNR is reevaluating the state's current rules regarding flood wall and levee regulations, and no final decisions have been made. When we're looking at things like, Bryce, the Rock Island Division of the Army Corps of Engineers, they released a study that said about 40% of the levees in the Quad City area are overbuilt. How do they get built up higher and higher, and how are they regulated? Is that something that just each side is just doing? They're just making theirs higher and higher?
Well, I was told when I did talk to some people up there that I think levees up in that area structurally can be a little different than down here. So I think it's more common for them to be made of sandy material up there, which gives them the ability to be sort of bulldozed higher during emergency river stages during flood events. And so, you know, what I've been told is that during some of these recent floods in 2008 is one instance that comes to mind, some of these levees may have been pushed higher and never really returned to their proper height. And, of course, this is disputed sort of on a case-by-case basis, with some levee districts saying that, you know, they don't have their levees improperly high now, and, you know, others saying that, that they do. And so, yeah, it's a very convoluted sort of system of levee management. Usually these individual levee districts manage levees, even if they were built by, you know, built federally by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Ah, I see. So that's how it gets managed. Let's bring someone else into this conversation. Bob Chris is a hydrologist with Washington University in St. Louis. Bob, thanks for being here. I wonder if you can help give us a little bit more perspective, because it seems like this might turn into a race between each state to build its levees higher. What impact do you think that has on the areas surrounding the Mississippi?
Well, of course, high levees force flood waters higher. That's been known a long time. In fact, Charles Ellet mentioned in a report to Congress before the Civil War that building real long levees too close to the river, too high for long distances, was a strategy that was not going to work.
So you're saying it actually makes it worse.
Sure, because when it floods, floodwaters have to occupy their natural floodplains. Those are topographically low areas that are sculpted by the river, by floodwaters. And flooding's a natural process, and floodplains are where flooding occurs. When we wall the river off, we are impeding its capacity to deal with high volumes of water. And that just makes the water rise up against the levees. And if somebody else has a lower levee, they're overtopped. And the thing is, when levees fail, you get a catastrophic wall of water that's extremely destructive.
Right, sure. And I think everyone remembers that, unfortunately, from Hurricane Katrina. Bob, what can be done to fix this? It doesn't sound like what's happening right now is really working.
The main thing we need to do is stop aggravating the problem. Even in St. Louis, even this morning, I was writing narratives for environmental groups about yet another floodplain development project in St. Louis County. And there are several of those going on right now, and there have been a whole slew of these kind of projects since the Great Flood in 1993. We have to quit building in low-lying areas. We need to stop aggravating the problem and using flooded, when properties are flooded out, we have to reevaluate whether it's smarter to relocate them to higher ground rather than trying to fix them up again.
Yeah, sounds like a difficult issue. But Bob, thanks for explaining that for us. I appreciate that. Bob Chris is a hydrologist with Washington University in St. Louis. Bryce Gray, a reporter with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who's been following this ongoing dispute. I imagine we'll continue to monitor that. Bryce, Bob, both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, stay tuned to the 21st. We're going to be shifting gears a little bit and talking about sports. The Chicago Cubs at the White House yesterday. Even President Trump was asking about how the team is doing. Cheryl Raystout's going to join us to give us a little bit more insight on that. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last November, we found ourselves talking again and again with WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Raystout about the Chicago Cubs after their amazing run to the World Series. I wish I could say things were going as well for the Cubs this year. I'm sorry, Cubs fans. Even President Trump mentioned it during the Cubs' visit to the White House yesterday. Now that baseball season's in full swing, we wanted to check back in with Cheryl to get an update on the season and get a rundown of other major sports stories playing across the state right now. Especially, it's been a busy week. Cheryl's on the line with us from Chicago. Hey, Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla.
Good morning. So let's start with the Cubs, which for people who are not following might be surprised to learn that things are not going so well. I feel like I should point out how different this conversation is from last year. The Cubs record was 51-26. Right now they're at 39-39. Cheryl, what's going on?
Well, their starting pitching, which was one of the best last year, has not been consistent. It's hard for the starters to go beyond five or six innings. They give up a lot of runs early. Players like Jake Arrieta and John Lackey, who are both going to be free agents at the end of the year, they have high ERAs. They gave up too many walks. In Lackey's case, too many home runs. So the burden has been falling on the bullpen. And offensively, they lost Dexter Fowler to St. Louis in free agency, and the experiment of Kyle Schwarber at leadoff man has failed. He's now at AAA Iowa trying to get his stroke back. And none of the players they had big years last year, Bryant, who was the MVP, Rizzo, and Zobrist, they've underperformed. So too many.
Yeah, what's going on with Brian? He's in kind of. I mean, he's not doing so great, huh? Is it? I mean, is it? Do we say slump? Is it slumper now, or what can we say?
It's a slump. I mean, he there was a period there where it looked like he was getting a stroke back, but he's prone to too many strikeouts. They are leaving runners on base. The defense too, because he looked brilliant at times, you know, Javi Baez, but then they could also look real bad. So it's been every aspect that they were good to great at last year is now mediocre or under average.
Yeah, and then Cheryl, this week, so the team's not doing great. We sort of saw this tension play out publicly this week. Catcher Miguel Montero got in trouble. It's his tweets in particular, complaining and about Jake Arrieta. And I think, you know, I think about catchers and pitchers, they're supposed to get along, right? They're supposed to be pretty close. First of all, let's just go over what Miguel Montero said before he got fired yesterday.
Well, what he actually did, he actually said it after a game. They had a game where they gave up, he and the pitcher, Jake Arrieta, gave up a lot of stolen bases, seven.
Together, both of them. We're gonna put the blame on both of them, right, Cheryl?
Absolutely. And you know what? Being observed, I am to baseball, we kept saying over and over, and we saw Jake Arrieta pitch, he's not holding runners on base. And it puts the onus on the catcher. With that said, it's an unwritten rule. You do not blast your teammate
after a
game.
Right. And what did he say, did. Cheryl? It was pretty rough.
Yeah, he said that, you know, what can I do if the pitcher isn't helping me? What can I do if, you know, the runners are running on me? And you can't say, I mean, he pointed a finger right at Jake Arrieta. Although, to also add, is that Miguel has not thrown out anybody this season. So it's not just
he's
Jake
not
Arrieta,
doing. So what? So that's the big question, right? So he was let go yesterday. How much of it was it because of his performance versus because of his attitude and what he said, we should say?
Well, I have to also cycle back is that he also had an issue with Joe Maddon after the World Series where he complained that he wasn't used well last year. So you have that history from last year, this year. Also, if this team was at the record they were a year ago, he would have been kept. The reason why they let him go, and this is the interesting thing, is Theo Epstein said because he has a young team, he didn't want to have this influence them. Which says an awful lot about that this team, are they fragile right now, that they can't handle anything negative? So it's an interesting situation right now for this Cubs team trying to figure out their chemistry, and now they let go a player who they thought was a negative. And we also understand is that that Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer, and Joe Maddon talked to other players, so they actually got the okay from players to do this.
Mm. Cheryl, how rare is it to have a catcher let go because they don't get along with the pitcher?
They don't usually do it vocally. It's usually done, you know, like, you know, a matter of a course of days where you see him being designated for assignment that way. This was so
very
visual.
Public and very, yeah.
Public. they had to do something. I was surprised that they did it, but I wasn't surprised in the sense that if their record was better, they wouldn't have done it.
Right. Yesterday, the Cubs visited the White House to celebrate their World Series win, a tradition all sports teams do. As we know, the Cubs already made it a point to visit President Obama before he left office. Right. You were there for that. That trip was a little controversial in the sense that some players didn't go. Yesterday also, some other players decided to not go to the White House.
Well, what it was the first time, that was the official visit, and that's the one where, the players are all lined up, they're told about it, it's all done in advance. And the reason why they did it then is because the players didn't want to do it during the season because it breaks up the rhythm of what they do. So yesterday was very much an unofficial visit, and the reason why they did it is because the ownership, the Ricketts family, are donors to the Trump campaign. And also one of the Ricketts, Todd Ricketts, was supposed to be in the cabinet, but did not, because of financial ties, did not do it. So you have this scenario where the team ownership wanted to do the visit and some of the players went with. And some players said, you know what, they were given the choice to do it or not do it. And some of them go, look, I want to get rest. I want to do this. Some of it was probably for political reasons they want to go. They didn't make it a forced event. And so you had a lot of players not there yesterday.
And I understand that President Trump, just from reading the accounts of it, said your team's doing okay, but you guys are going to start doing great now, right? After saying this is a great team, he's like, oh, maybe you guys aren't. You need to be doing a little bit better. Didn't he really say that?
Yeah, you know, who cares what he says.
Okay. Well, let's switch from President Trump's comments about the Cubs and sports to the Sox. We haven't seen much news out of the South Side this year. How are the Sox doing this year, Cheryl?
Well, they're struggling on the major league level. With that said, their minor league system is really starting to, you know, develop players there. They got one of the top farm systems in baseball. Jose Quintana, who is one of their best pitchers, he's starting to really come back and pitch well. He will be probably traded at the trading deadline, which will be the end of next month. You have other players that could be on the trading block. So I was talking to some scouts. The scouts are looking at some of the bullpen players that they have. They also are possibly could be trading Todd Frazier. They did sign Cuban star Luis Robert. He's a 5-2 player, 19 years old. They have a lot of players that will be coming into focus in the next year or two. Sox fans should be happy once this starts developing because this could be a really interesting, powerful team in the future.
So do you think we can predict 4 or 5 years from now, maybe a Cubs Sox World Series a few years down the road, Cheryl?
Oh, we can dream, can't we, Nyla?
All right.
You know what? They could be improved enough to do that. Baseball is the hardest sport to win championships because you play 162 games. You have 25 men on your roster. You have injuries that can happen. You have players that you think are going to develop and they don't. It's really a difficult, difficult sport to predict.
Speaking of championships teams, let's go back to our previous Stanley Cup winning Blackhawks and ask what's been going on this past year. And I guess now the offseason, pretty kind of disappointing end for the Hawks. Can we talk about the headlines that have been happening with the Blackhawks right now in the offseason, Cheryl?
Oh, yeah. Well, first off, when you get swept in a playoff series to start to end the season, and Stan Bowman, the general manager, comes out and says, we're going to make changes, and he did. And he immediately dismissed Coach Quinville's assistant and also Coach Quinville's best friend, Mike Kitchen. Doing that, he started turning on changing the roster. And two of the biggest trades he made was on the same day at the draft. He traded Nick Jalmerson, probably their best defenseman, to Arizona for Connor Murphy. And then he traded Artemi Panarin to Columbus to bring back Brandon Saad. And the reason why they brought back Brandon Saad is because of what happened to Marian Hossa, which is one of the most unfortunate and sad stories in sports. Here's a Hall of Famer who has been dealing with, and we did not know this, as far as the media and publicly, we did not know this, that he has been dealing with a skin irritation that has required him to take medications that has been so difficult for him to deal with, the pain and the difficulties of the drugs he's been dealing with, that he cannot play. He's not going to play next year, and we understand it's probably the rest of his career he will not be back as a Blackhawk. So they had to do something, and so that's why they traded for Brandon Saad. This is a team that we're not going to recognize. They had to redo their defense because the defense was slow. They did not play well against Nashville, and it was really glaring. So it's a team that's in transition but still trying to hold on to win cups. It's going to be interesting to watch.
All right, let's transition to basketball. The Bulls have had a really busy offseason, fans reeling from the loss of Jimmy Butler. This has been kind of crazy offseason stuff when we're talking about hockey or basketball. Let's talk about the NBA because there's been a lot going on. But let's start with the Bulls.
Well, on draft night, they made a decision. They're going to rebuild. And this would be the second team that Jerry Reinsdorf owns that's going to rebuild. And so they sent Jimmy Butler to Minnesota, to the Timberwolves. In exchange, they got two players and a draft pick. And with those three players, they got Zach LaVine and Chris Dunn. And the draft pick is Lauri Markkanen. He's a tall, seven-foot forward, stretch forward. But the two players they got from Minnesota, one is Chris Dunn that they wanted last year in the trade for Jimmy Butler, and that didn't work out. He had a rough year under Coach Thibodeau up there. And Zach LaVine, he injured his ACL in February, and he won't be back for a while. But he was starting to really evolve, and it was a really nice mix. Here's the big key that's going to happen in the next 24 hours. We will find out if the Bulls will be keeping Rajon Rondo. They own the option to him. And the other factor is, will Dwayne Wade still be a Bull going forward? Because he picked up his option last week before the draft. Now it's on rebuild mode. He wants that $24 million, but does he want to be with a real building team? And the Bulls own that future for him.
Right, and we're not going to – let me ask you one more question that's Bulls-related. We'll say it's Phil Jackson, which we'll say it's Bulls-adjacent news, right? He fired yesterday as the New York Knicks team president. Cheryl, as someone who covered him during his historic run with the Bulls, do you think this changes any perception, his legacy? Do you think in Chicago we don't care? I have to say, reading the New York Post headlines yesterday were very disrespectful about Phil Jackson. What do you think?
Well, he'll never be liked in New York, but in L.A. and in Chicago, he'll still be revered for what he did as a coach. He was a tremendous coach. He was just a terrible general manager president. Michael Jordan found that out when he tried to do that in Washington. There's places that you are really, really great at, and then you find out it's not so great being doing other jobs. He was not a good president, general manager. He did some good things, but overall, he had very archaic thinking. He didn't want to change the way the game was played. He wanted them to continue to do his style of offense, and the game has changed so much. It's more towards the way the Golden State Warriors are, and he was not building a team that way. So it's a shame that he's leaving New York under these conditions. But Chicagoans and of course, out in L.A., they'll revere him as being the best head coach we've ever seen.
All right, we're going to stick with that in Chicago and for the rest of Illinois. We're going to continue to revere Phil Jackson. We're going to disregard the past couple of years and what New York says. I like that. Cheryl Reisout is WBEZ Chicago's sports contributor. Cheryl, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Some news before we sign up for the day. A revised version of the Trump administration's travel ban will go into effect today at 7 p.m. Central Time. This comes after the Supreme Court decided earlier this week to hear the case in October. Until then, a partial version of the travel ban will be enforced. We were expecting that would be sometime today, so that will be this evening. The State Department has said travelers visiting from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen will not be given visas to the U.S. unless they're already working or studying in the country or if a very close family member is here. So we'll be monitoring the story. Stay tuned to your local NPR station throughout the day for more of this as it develops. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Enable NPR One and tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us is at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.